We're going to go ahead and get started in the interest of time. My name is Denise Saunders. Welcome to Planning for a Career Satisfaction and Success. We are going to spend some time this morning talking about planning for career and professional development and your career and professional lives, talking a little bit about career decision making and self-assessment and the aspects of yourself that you need to know in order to make good, informed, effective decisions, as well as those things about options, whether they be graduate school programs or thinking about particular positions or occupations that you might want to pursue, how to get some of that knowledge, talk more about the whole decision-making process, and then, you know, kind of how you can take some steps to move forward and take some action. I am primarily working for the OITE, the Office of Intramural Training and Education, in the North Carolina, Raleigh-Durham area. The National Institutes of Environmental Health Safety is there, and I do some individual work with many of the postdoc fellows who are there, as well as do some of this outreach and workshops and so forth, and I've done some of that here and have been out to the Rocky Mountain Labs, too. So I have been to a couple of the different institutes, but mostly I'm down in North Carolina, which is where I reside. I have been here some to work individually with some of the trainees, but also providing some of the outreach through workshops and seminars and so forth. Now, as I understand, everyone here is in a post-bac position, right, training position here. How long have you all been here? A few months? Anybody in their second year? Couple of you? Okay. Where are you at in terms of your decision making? Everybody's going to graduate school, mostly? Yeah? Sort of thinking about that. Do you have some ideas about what you want to pursue? Some. I imagine that's why you're here today, right?
Well, I'm on a much higher level.
You are? Oh, okay, okay. How about some of the other? Are there some things that you're considering right now?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Oh, the questions, sure. Okay, we're being videotaped, so I need to be careful that I am communicating for those who are watching a video what is being said. So we were just hearing comment about pursuing postdocs who are looking at interdisciplinary areas of work as well as considering industry. Anybody else want to share some of the things that you're considering at this point?
I'm a postdoc, so I'm considering not.
Okay. Exploring options that would not necessarily take you directly to graduate school. Okay. A post-bac who was saying they were looking at other opportunities besides graduate school. Well, my background is predominantly in higher education. I've worked in university and college career centers as well as counseling centers and taught some at the undergraduate and graduate level, and have just, you know, really immersed myself in this career development area. So I'm excited to be here to share a little bit about this, because I do think with information and understanding a little bit about how one goes about making career decisions, it kind of falls into place for you. I don't know about you, but when I'm faced with a tough decision, and these are important life decisions, if you don't know how to go about doing it, it seems a little bit overwhelming and you're not even really sometimes quite sure where to start. Because I am without my PowerPoint right now, what I'm going to do, oh, here we go. Hey. That's great. All right. This was our introductory slide. This quote right here by David Campbell, I think, really sort of captures the importance of thinking about what you're going to do and really planning for that. If you don't know where you're going, you'll probably end up somewhere else. David Campbell is quoted as saying this in the mid-70s. And if you think about that for a moment, intuitively, that certainly makes sense. If you have not planned and thought through what you want, where you want to be, what kind of career and personal aspirations and goals you have, guess what? You're not going to get there because you don't have a vision for it. You don't know where you're headed. So today's presentation is really an opportunity to share a little bit with you. I mentioned just a little bit about our overview, but I'll go over this overview slide. I'm going to share a little bit of information in general about how one goes about making decisions. How do you go about making career decisions? I want to spend some time talking about the importance of self-assessment, about understanding oneself, exploring options, and share a little bit of information about where you might go, what resources you can tap into. Decision-making skills is a very important component of career decision-making and problem-solving. And so we'll talk a little bit about different decision-making styles and ultimately sort of giving you some assistance in finding a good fit and exploring that as a possibility. I want to touch on briefly goal setting and how to sort of work at establishing an appropriate work-life or work-personal life balance, and then taking action and creating a plan. So that's a little bit about what we're going to be covering this morning. This graphic illustration that you see here really highlights for us what's involved in career choice. The theorist who came up with this particular theory, this is one theory, theoretical approach to career decision making and problem solving, and I like it because it has this graphic. I use it all the time, and I find that it really helps those that are in the midst of some aspect of career decision making. So let me kind of go over this for you. It is in a pyramid structure because, much like the pyramids in Egypt, it's very heavy and dense at the bottom, at the base. In this case, the heaviness and the density is from information or knowledge that you need. You'll notice at the bottom here, you need to know a lot about yourself. What kinds of things would you think would be important for you to know about yourself when you are engaging in making a career choice? What things would you need to know? Anybody, what would you think you need to know? You can guess.
Your skills.
Mm-hmm. Your personality. Interests, absolutely. Others? Anything else you can think about yourself that you might need to know? How you deal with others, so just sort of interpersonally, what's most comfortable for you. Did someone else have a comment? Any others? Yes.
The things that you like and the things that you don't like?
Sure. Okay, so all of that is kind of knowing about myself. It's called self-knowledge or self-information. Interests, values, and skills are the key components of that. But I heard personality, that's an important component. Likes and dislikes is sort of like interests, strengths and weaknesses we might look at more as skills. Other things like personal needs, learning styles, and so forth is all about you. And the more that you know about yourself, the easier it is to look at the options. And options is going to change depending on what kind of decision you're in the midst of. So it could be for many of you, it may be graduate programs, what to pursue, who offers what. What can I do with a degree in such and such? It may be that you are looking more for employment opportunities and you're saying to yourself, do I look at academia versus industry or not even non-traditional kinds of science careers? And looking at options would entail a lot of that information for you. Having information in both of these areas allows you to make those connections to see whether or not that would be a good fit for you, and then to more effectively, more comfortably, more confidently move forward in this middle section of the period to better understanding how you make decisions and actually engaging in the decision-making process. This top part of the pyramid, thinking about my decision-making, has to do with the way in which we think about ourselves as decision-makers. We all walk around every day and there's this kind of statements going through our heads and, you know, it's what we call self-talk or self-statements. Most of the time they're very positive, they're affirming, they're uplifting. You know, we say, you know, you did great at that, or gee, you look good in that outfit, or wow, you know, that was quite an accomplishment. Those would be more positive, uplifting comments. Sometimes this kind of thinking can be a bit more critical. It can kind of have a negative or a pessimistic bent to it. Either way, the way in which you think about yourself as a decision maker has a top-down effect. So it can impact how you view information about yourself, how you gather it, how accurately you see it, and how well you're able to use it. It also has an impact on how you consider your options. Again,
how accurately you view that information, how effectively you can utilize that, and if ultimately how effectively you can engage in the decision-making process. So I present this sort of as a model, as a way to think about approaching the process of career decision making. And what I'm going to do throughout the morning is just take that apart a little bit by bit. So we're going to spend more time. We're going to spend a lot of time talking about, you know, knowledge about self and how you can go about assessing some of those particular personal characteristics. We're going to share some information about the options, talk about resources that are available to you and where you can go to get them. And then I want to spend a fair amount of time talking about this whole notion of decision making. And, you know, sometimes we feel kind of stuck or stalled and what that might entail and how we can sort of overcome that. Okay, so let's go ahead and move forward. All right, everybody has a handout called The Party. You'll see that it has the hexagon on there. And what I want us to do is actually engage in an activity that gets you up, moving around the room, and thinking about yourself and your various interests and who you are as a person and your personality. So what I'd like for you to do, I think, did everybody get a blank piece of paper? There's a couple different times I'm going to have you write some things down. So just pull that out. It doesn't matter. You're not turning that in. That's only for you to use. What I'd like for you to do initially is to read over the hexagon. So read about, we're going to call this is an aerial view of a room. And there's a big social gathering. There's a party going on. These all represent, the different letters represent different corners of the room. So read each of those. I'm going to give you a couple of minutes just to read over those. And I'm going to ask you to decide a few things for me. Okay, after you've read that, I want you to think in terms of yourself. Let's just imagine that you were invited to this party and there are these groups of people all around the room. And you notice we have some letters all around our room. So you're actually going to be at the party. What I want you to do initially is to decide which corner of the room would you be most instinctively drawn to. In other words, what group of people do you feel is most like yourself that you would enjoy visiting with or share most things in common and you would enjoy being with for the longest time? So identify that corner of the room. And don't think about, you know, having to talk or shyness issues in particular. Just sort of set that aside and just pick the room that you would be or that particular corner that you would enjoy being with that group of people for the longest length of time. And write down that is the letter that would be number one for you. Okay? Does everybody have number one? Okay. Some time passes, the party's continuing, and you know what? There's apparently another party cross town going on, and this group of folks that you were visiting with all had an invitation to that, and you didn't. I don't know what happened. It must have gotten lost in the mail. At any rate, they now leave. So you're standing there in the corner of the room by yourself. Second, now choose in terms of your second choice, what corner of that room would you be most drawn to with the first one eliminated? So every corner in the room you've chosen, they leave, and of the groups that still remain, which corner or group would you be drawn to the most as the people you would enjoy being with for the longest time? So this is your second choice. Indicate that and then write that letter down as number two. No, you have to pick one. You get one letter choice for the first one, one letter choice for the second one, and now Time passes again. Some time has passed, and boy, it's a party night. I don't know what's going on, but this group of people is also heading out to another social gathering, and you're left behind once again. So choose now which corner of the room that you would be drawn to, eliminating your first two choices. What would be your third choice? And that corner of the room or that letter is now number three. All right, everybody with me? So you've got you have three letters in a code, 1, 2, 3, right? Okay. Now, you did get an invitation to the party, so I'm going to invite you to attend the party. The party is in this room, and the letters are around the walls. So what I'd like for you to do now is to go to the corner or that area of the room that has your first letter. There are some questions at the bottom of the sheet, and I'm also going to put them up on the screen to just sort of prompt some conversation with those that are in that corner. Why did you choose this letter? How do you express these descriptors in your life, work, or play? And then what is the most satisfying or fulfilling about this particular activity for you? Okay, so I'm going to give you some time to visit and chat with those folks and just interact and use these questions as a prompt. All right, everybody can go to your corner. Visit amongst yourself. Is anyone by themselves? I'll go visit with them. You all can. Is everybody in an I, or we have a few A's over here? Is there some A's? Those of you who are I's, everybody here is I. Move in closer. Start talking with those who are in your corner. How did you choose this letter? Why did you choose this letter? We got a bunch of S's back here. You A's? All the A's? Your C?
Thank you.
Right. I hope you've had an enjoyable time at the party so far. What I'm going to ask you to do now is go to your second letter. If you are traveling with some of the same people, that's fine. It just gives you more opportunity to visit and chat. So go now to your second letter. move to the last letter, your last room of the social event at this particular party. I hope you're having a great time. It sounds like just exciting conversation going on. Are you learning to know things about people you didn't know? And you striking up interesting conversations? Are some of you finding you got the exact same three letters? You must have a lot in common. Newfound friends.
Hi, you're back.
All right. The people didn't go over there.
Is this the cohort that's moved I, S, now R? I need my Holland Codebook. Okay.
Thank you.
Oh, okay. I understand. Well, I think we're being taped, so you can tune in for that stuff. Okay. All right, everybody. The party is nearing a close. Everybody's going home. What we did in that activity was a very informal, sort of quick and easy way at getting at a Holland code. John Holland is a career theorist who has been around for many years. He's actually quite elderly now and may not be with us so much longer. But internationally, globally, he is probably the leading career theorist. And his understanding of the organization or the schema in which we organize the world of work and think about people and their place in different environments in the world of work is probably the most widely used. Several interest assessments are built loosely based on Holland theory. The strong interest inventory is one that is loosely based on Holland theory, and Holland has his own assessment tool. So Holland theory is a way of understanding the world of work, different environments. Holland believed that the world of work could be understood and described based on these six different types. So those are realistic, investigative, artistic, social, enterprising, and conventional. And in a moment I'm going to explain a bit more about what all that means. So he says, you know, the world of work can be understood in those six different types. And then he went on to say that people could also be described using that typology in those six different types. So that if you had someone who was very investigative in nature, chances are they would be most satisfied and happiest and most comfortable in an environment that was predominantly investigative. Now, Holland did not see occupations or people as being very specific. In other words, who had an I in their code? A number of you, probably a lot of you. If you had an I in your code or if you had an S in your code, it would be very difficult to say, oh, you're a social person or you're an investigative person, and find occupations or work environments that would be pure investigative or pure social. Instead, Holland really believed that it was a combination of these types that more accurately reflects occupations, work environments, and individuals. And so that's why we have you look at three, that there are probably characteristics of those that you find enjoyment from and satisfaction from every day, and it may even incorporate some of the things that you do in your leisure. So it sort of looks at you in a more holistic way. So that's a little bit about Holland's theory. Let me share with you now about the party and how to interpret that. So realistic, investigative, artistic, social, enterprising, and conventional are those different types. Realistic is work environments that tend to see things very concretely. They're more data-focused and things-focused as opposed to ideas or people-focused. And we might find that those individuals kind of like working outside. I think the description there is sometimes manipulating things with their hands or tools, doing a lot of outside work. So anybody have an idea about an occupation that would fall under realistic? Yes?
Construction.
Construction, yes. A lot of skilled labor, manual work, construction would all fall under realistic. What about some facets of engineering? Probably civil engineers, for example. They're outside, they're measuring things, they're building bridges, constructing roads. Probably more realistic. In their free time, they may be out doing extreme sports and, you know, doing a lot of athletic, doing outdoor kind of things. In an environmental biologist, for example, who's doing a lot of field work, out testing samples, might also be predominantly realistic. So those are examples of things that might fall under that realistic area. How about investigative? Investigative is a work environment or is descriptive of an environment that has outlets for ideas, a lot of thinking, creative thinking, problem solving. They're the critical thinkers. So we might find scientists in this particular area, people who have backgrounds in biology and chemistry and physics, biochemistry. What kind of occupation might fall under investigative? I see some whispers. A scientist, yes. A researcher, yes. A detective, yeah, because they're out, you know, kind of problem solving. People who do computer programming would probably fall predominantly on this investigative area because they're always solving problems. You know, if you got a computer glitch, let me figure it out. There are similarities between realistic and investigative in that they're more things-focused, data-focused, but also in the investigative, we're now moving more to ideas. The next one would be artistic. So if we kind of go around in that hexagon, the next one would be artistic. And that is reflective of work environments or environments that would have significant creative outlets. We might think about that in terms of the fine arts being represented there. But creativity also means probably opportunity for a lot of independent work, because the more independence that you have on the job, the greater the opportunity to be creative in what you're doing. Does a researcher need to have some creativity? Sure, to come up with the ideas, with the big ideas and their possibility people. But a true artistic environment, or someone who's sort of more a pure artistic individual, would probably have more of an appreciation for the arts and culture, maybe play, write or paint, or be an artist or a musician. We'd sort of see those things coming out. Social and enterprising are actually similar in that they are both focused on working with people. Social people tend to be in environments where they're working more on a one-to-one basis, so there's a lot of interaction and more opportunity to learn to know each other, whereas investigative people are more one to a group. Social environments might have outlets for this one-to-one, so it could involve like counseling or teaching. A lot of education opportunities fall under social. Some facets of healthcare would fall under social because there's that interaction with your patients. Particular other occupations that you might think of that I haven't mentioned, what other things might fall under social? Librarians, actually. A lot of librarians go into library science because they want to be able to help the public. And especially those folks who are at the reference desk, that's what they're there for. They are helpers to give out information and to help instruct you about where you can go to find your resources. Enterprising. Enterprising is more of an opportunity or an outlet for one-to-a-group communication, so it might involve skills like public speaking, marketing, advertising, managerial sorts of skills. Any other occupations that you can think of might fall under that enterprising area. Management, so managers would have to have fairly strong E's. Other ones? Can you think of any others? Yeah, so
the problem here was one should have more than at least 3 to 4 such characters or letters. So that's why it's a little difficult for me to begin with them, prioritize.
He's saying that but he was feeling a little bit challenged to have to identify just 3 because you felt like you needed to sort of be all over the place and have a little bit of all of that. And you probably do, but in some lesser, some greater. And it may be that at times in a position that you hold, you're called upon to do something that you know is sort of a weakness area for you, but you gather strength in doing that. It might not be the thing that you do best about your work, but you can still do that. So don't think that if it's not in your code, those are things that you wouldn't want to do or you couldn't do. You probably wouldn't be as happy doing them or as satisfied doing them. And there's a distinction there. So enterprising, most characterizes a lot of opportunities within the business field. You know, true entrepreneurs, people who are doing their own businesses probably fall into that enterprising area. Advertising, marketing, law, and politics would also fall under enterprising, because there's that opportunity for power and influence, which are other characteristics that fall under enterprising. Conventional, then, which is the last one, and we had that over here on this side of the room, these folks like environments that provide sort of outlets for security and stability. They pride themselves in their organizational skills and attention to detail. They're probably very good at numbers and number crunching. They sort of like that. What kinds of occupations would fall under conventional, would you think? Accountants, yes. Probably very strong conventional traits. Mm-hmm. Others? A statistician, absolutely, because they're just looking at numbers all the time and need a lot of order and detail, don't they? Anybody else? Any other suggestions? How about those people who help us, who support us in our work, like all of our support staff and administrative assistants? They probably have fairly strong conventional bent and sort of traits and type as well, because they're very good at what they do. Without them, a lot of us would not be doing the work that we are, because we are supported by people who really are good at schedules and planning and attention to detail and so forth. So that's just kind of an overview to this RIASEC. It's called RIASEC. Collins theory is sometimes referred to as RIASEC, which are the beginning letters of all those different types. Let me just have you guess. Oh, I was trying to see in our room here what our code was as a group. The predominant code, I believe, was investigative, social, and realistic. Was that the largest group that sort of moved around? So this campus, the NIH campus, I would think would be very heavily investigative, because we have researchers all over the place. I don't know if it would be those three letters, but for this group, that was sort of the predominant theme. What would you think my code is? Can you guess what my code is? What would be my first letter? I'm a counseling psychologist. Yes, my first letter is S. What's my second letter? I? All right, I's. How many say I? I heard one person say I. Yes, okay, be honest. All right, how many people say E? I heard E also. It's actually an E. I am in business for myself. I have a private practice, which is a bit of a stretch for me, and I do a lot of public speaking, so I like doing that sort of thing, and I generate, you know, work and ideas and so forth. So I'm getting outside of my social part and doing more of that investigative. How about my third letter? It is. It's an A. I appreciate culture. I like creativity. I like working independently, but I like the opportunity to do creative work. So that's my code. All right, let's move on. This is an example, remember, of getting information about self. So I'm going to go back just real quick to our pyramid here. And remember, at the base, we were talking about the key components of making a career choice, knowing about oneself. So now I have a slide that goes into more detail about those aspects of information about oneself. Interests, which is kind of what we did just now, very, very quickly, is a way of gathering information about what you're interested in, what you don't like to do, what you do like to do. Another part of this is skills, and sometimes that's referred to as strengths and weaknesses. What are you good at? What have you achieved? Where have you had a lot of achievement in your life? What do you enjoy doing? And then lastly here, values. Values means, you know, sort of what's important to you in your life. What are your priorities? And the bottom line is, what's important to you on the job? What do you want? How do you want your work to fulfill different needs in your life? Personality, or about those specific characteristics or traits that you possess. And the middle section here, best fit, we wouldn't want to be making decisions solely based on what our interests were. We wouldn't want to make decisions solely based on a particular skill set that we hold. It's really considering all of these things and some other characteristics that I haven't mentioned, personal needs and learning style and so forth, that would also be put into this mix of what we call personal characteristics to identify who you are, and then hopefully looking at your options and coming up with the best fit. Here are some examples of work-related values. I think a lot of times when people consider career decision-making, they overlook the importance of values. And particularly as you get beyond undergraduate and you start in your graduate programs and advancing in your professional life, values become very, very important. You know, after 9/11, there were sort of people all over our country who were changing the way they looked at themselves, the way that they looked at their world, and the way that they considered significant relationships in their life. And that is a reflection of a change or an altering in priorities or values. And that's going to happen to you in life too, hopefully not because of a significant national tragedy like that, but events in your life will encourage you or make you reconsider what's important to you. So what I have up here on the screen are just some examples of work-related values, desire for variety on the job, or you know, a need to help society in some way or to contribute, to work independently, to have a leadership role, to be recognized for the work that you do, to, you know, kind of have lifelong learning. These are all, would all be examples of that. There are not so many formal ways to assess that, but lots of informal ways. So if that's something that you feel like you need to get more information about, maybe you just sit down and you brainstorm what's really important to you on the job, and you come up with a list similar to this. In addition to values, there are those skills or strengths, and again, I've just included just kind of a snapshot of some possible examples that you might have that may reflect some of the work that you're currently doing, where you're analyzing or conceptualizing and researching and investigating. The key thing about the skills, particularly if you are, as you're exploring graduate school programs or thinking about what kinds of positions you might have, if you are continuing to pursue further education in the sciences and you're not sure that an academic position is for you, then you really need to begin thinking about those transferable skills. How can you apply what you do day to day at the bench in the lab in a research capacity, and how would those skills be transferred or translated in a different, you know, sort of like an industry? How would they understand what I do? And so coming up with what you're good at, you know, think about what you're good at and what you're doing in your research, and then look at that and look more broadly at that. How does that apply to other areas? And we call those transferable skills. There are some other personal characteristics that I haven't mentioned. Personality traits, just who are you as an individual? How do you interact with the world? How do you interact with others? How do you approach tasks? How do you gather information? All of that has to do with your personality traits. Personal needs is things like, are you needing to consider geography in the career choice that you make? For example, are you looking only at graduate programs in a particular region of the country or job opportunities in a particular area? Do you need to consider dual relationship issues or dual career issues? Are there family issues? Is there someone ill or needing care that you don't want to be very far from? And again, that may limit you in terms of what you may choose to do, but also in terms of geography. Are there financial issues or are there cultural issues that you need to consider as a part of who you are when you're making these choices? I want to just touch on briefly learning style. Are people familiar with their learning styles and they kind of understand how you learn best? You all have been very successful at students, and my guess is that you would continue to be if you decide to pursue higher education, further education. But you may be very good at visual learning. In other words, you like seeing things and you take information in well from visually when you're reading or, here, seeing something, and visually you take that information in. Someone who has more of an auditory learning style probably prefers lecture or discussion or interaction with others and may learn through that, in that capacity, a bit more comfortably. Someone who has a tactile or kinesthetic learning style likes doing. So as you are learning more about options and learning more about yourself, if you recognize that you're more reflective of that third learning style, you may want to actually test it out. Go shadow someone or have a summer opportunity where you are actually doing what you think you might want to do in the future. So it gives you sort of more of that hands-on learning. How can you clarify all this information about yourself? Well, first and foremost, you want to confirm your interests. For some of you, that may be, you know, a very formal clarification. For others, it may be just reconfirmation or reclarification of that. The OITE does offer the strong interest inventory as a way to assess that and further clarify some of that information. Explore your values. Consider what is important to you. Review your skills and strengths, so think about that a bit further and how that information will inform you as you make choices. Determine your personality characteristics. One way to formally do that is by taking the Myers-Briggs Type Indicator. Have any of you taken that? Sometimes you take that in classes or in training environments. But that speaks to how you interact with others, how you approach problems, how you solve problems, how you interact with the environment in general. So it helps you better understand yourself, how you may react to somebody who is, or how you work with someone who has a very different personality style than you do. That recognition of personal needs that I mentioned. And then, you know, finally, there are career counselors available at the OITE if you want to just sit and have a one-on-one conversation with them or session with them. You can schedule to do that. I think to do that, you need to send an email directly to Catherine Foisey, and she will get you scheduled on their calendar. So that's a little bit about self-knowledge. Let's go back to our pyramid. And we have talked quite a bit about this area. The more that you know about yourself, the easier it is to look at all these options and to be able to say with greater certainty, that seems like a really good fit for me, or gee, knowing what I know about that particular area or about myself, that's probably not a good choice. So you do need to have sufficient information about yourself before you can really fully look at these other options. Options knowledge is very dependent on the particular decision that you are in the midst of. Many of you are trying to decide whether or not you want to go to graduate school. And if so, is this true? Yes, some head nods. And if so, what programs you're going to pursue. As you get closer to knowing what it is that you want to do, then you're also going to be looking at particular schools, program options, faculty that you might be working with. So that's going to be a very different career decision choice process than someone who's looking for employment, who's saying, you know, I need to embark on a job search. I'm not sure what I want to do, but I need to find out about this occupation, this occupation, and this occupation. So it's very dependent on the decision that is being made. Generally, options and knowledge relates to that decision, but when we think about that in an occupational sense, it's related to the responsibilities and duties of the occupation and the position. So what are the qualifications? What are the educational requirements? What would be the opportunities for advancement, the salary, the specific tasks and duties that I would be asked to do? Who would I be working with? And two, consider, let's say you're pretty certain what you want to do. You've embarked on a job search, or you are decided upon, you know, this particular program. You know, I want to do a combination MD, PhD kind of a thing. All right, so you know that. But even knowing that, there are still lots of choices open to you. Go to a program, go to a school, pick a job that's going to be a best fit for you. And the more that you know about that option, the easier it is for you to make that decision. So it's really getting back to that pyramid. We need to have sufficient information in both of those areas and make those connections that allows us to then move into the decision-making process, feeling really comfortable and confident that we know what we need, we have the information that we need, and now we can make those choices. Resources for options knowledge, there's some information on the OITE website, so you can go there and access some information. Informational interviewing and networking are both ways of gathering information. Who's familiar with an information interview? Who knows what an information interview is? Yeah? You want to tell us? You'll try.
Sure.
Thank you.
Informational interview is it's kind of like job shadowing, is my impression. Like you try and make contact with someone and get a feel for what they do as a job. Not with the intent of getting a job there, but just to learn more.
That's a very good description. You're absolutely right. The distinction between an information interview is that the purpose of meeting with someone is to learn more, get more information. In other words, let's say I really am thinking I might want to work for a clinical research organization that I don't know anything that they do, and I don't know how you get there. What kind of training do they have? Do I have to get a PhD to do that? I want to go talk to somebody who's working in that organization, and I'm going to ask them if they would have some time to talk with me about their position and how they got there. It's an information interview. You go with your list of prepared questions, and you are interviewing them for the sole purpose of gathering information. Now, the difference between that and networking is where you make contact with people who you know in your network for hopefully the ultimate end being a possibility of a job offer. Your network consists of the people that you know, could be neighbors, it could be friends, colleagues, former mentors, current mentors, postdocs working in your lab, other staff working in your lab, all these people that you are networked with, and they hopefully then will lead you to other contacts, and down the line, somewhere down the line, you never know, but somebody may have a job opening that they refer to you. Positions that I have gotten, I would have to say, at least the more recent ones, are always through someone that I know. And it's not, you know, it's sort of cynical to say, well, you know, the job market is really kind of who you know. It's really not about that. It's just people who have effectively used their network. They're talking to people. They're letting people know what they're looking for. They're always finding out what others are doing and making those connections so that when it comes to looking for a job, they're able to say with certainty, here's what I'm looking for, connect with people who they think might lead them to other opportunities. And that's really what that's about. So those are both ways of information interviewing can help you to learn more about what you're interested in doing. You can check print resources. There are books in bookstores. There's a library here on the NIH campus, and they probably have some resources. The OITE office has a nice library now, as I understand. You can go look at some resources that are there. There's lots of information on the web. So if you just Google, let's say, I don't know, name an occupation, you can just Google it, and you get information on the web on that particular occupation. An excellent resource, both in print and on the web, is called the Occupational Outlook Handbook. This gives not in-depth information, but very sort of bird's-eye snapshot pictures of particular occupational titles. So if you want to go and find out what a science writer does, you put in science writer. First, you go to that page, and you can then pull up a whole sheet of information about what a science writer does. Get information about the salary and the requirements and the trends. And then the nice thing about the Occupational Outlook Handbook is that it also gives you related occupations. So a science writer is similar to science journalist, or, you know, it would list three or four different things. So it helps you to expand the things that you're considering. Websites for job search, there's a lot of good websites as well. The sciencecareers.org is a particularly good website for various opportunities within the science fields. And then all sorts of state, national, and regional professional organizations. For many of you who are now in post-bac positions here at NIH, it will be important for you to be networked professionally, to think about, you know, what your identity is going to be, with which professional group do you want to have sort of your primary identity. And those professional organizations not only sometimes have job listings, but they also have a wealth of information about opportunities in their field, potential networking or information interviewing contacts as well. So there's a lot of good information there. Okay, we're going to move on to talking about decision-making, and now decision-making is that middle section of the pyramid that I showed earlier. Decision-making is a process of identifying and choosing alternatives based on the values and preferences of the decision-maker. Decision-making is a process of sufficiently reducing uncertainty and doubt about alternatives. Now, I know that nobody in this room has ever had not even an inkling of uncertainty or doubt, right? I know I have. So decision-making is a way of going about sort of reducing the uncertainty, the doubt, and the more that you know about your choices, the more comfortable you will be in actually taking action, making a commitment to a choice and taking action. Decision-making style is an important component of the whole decision-making process. Everyone has different decision-making styles, and one is not better than another. So let me just sort of outline this for you. There are two kind of, Johnson and Coscarelli, who have both been independently and jointly doing research and writing, they're in the literature quite a bit on decision-making styles, came up with this sort of quadrant thing where there were two continuums, one being methods of gathering information, and those were defined by either being a spontaneous decision-making style or a more systematic decision-making style. Those who are spontaneous tend to have holistic reactions to events. So they see something or they experience something and they have a reaction to it. They either like it or they don't. They may focus on details about things. They have flexible goals that seem to be chained together, and they move quickly from goal to goal. That would be more of a kind of a spontaneous decision-making style. People who are on more of this, the other end of the continuum, more systematic decision makers,
are planful, informed, they're more deliberate about their decision-making. They assume responsibility for the decision outcomes. And sometimes, you know, that may see them to a fault. I take too much responsibility for the decision outcome. But they, you know, recognize that, I need to accept and take responsibility for what that choice will lead to. They break events into component parts, so they see that as a more progression or a series of decisions maybe needing to be made. They may be more cautious about commitment to a particular choice, and they like having long-range goals. So think about yourself. Are you more spontaneous in your decision-making or more systematic? And that would be sort of the continuum there. The other continuum is external versus internal. And they define this as the way in which you analyze information. So spontaneous, systematic was the way in which you gathered information. This continuum has to do with the way in which you analyze information. External analyzers, decision-making style, they would tend to think out loud. I don't know, have you ever been around someone who's in the midst of a decision and they just want to talk it through and they're talking about it. Sometimes people aren't even listening, but it's important that they are talking through that decision for themselves. They're thoroughly discussed, sometimes not even with others, but, you know, maybe in their own head or maybe out loud to themselves, and they may think aloud while weighing the pros and cons. Versus someone who has more of an internal decision-making style, is going to think that through thoroughly before they talk about it. You know, you've been in class before, and there's a discussion occurring, and some people can just, you know, they're quick, and they just share information all the time, and then, you know, maybe you're one of these people sitting back. It's the way in which you process the information. It's not that you don't have a response, but it takes you more time to think it through, to formalize your thoughts, to share the information than it would somebody who's more externally in terms of their decision style. Here is a guide to good decision making. You'll notice there at the top of me is my pointer here. Anytime you make a decision, now we're talking specifically about career decisions, but this model and even the pyramid could be used for all sorts of life decisions. You start up here knowing that you need to make a choice. My guess is that all of you signed up to come to this workshop today because there is a choice in your lives that need to be made related to your career and professional life. Something happens. Your postdoc finishes or your postdoc is going to end. You're not sure what you're going to do when you leave. You're sitting at the bench every day and it's not feeling as comfortable. You don't like it as much as you thought you were. Something has happened in your life to suggest to you that a decision needs to be made. So from that point, you go to a place at which you are further understanding yourself and all of your options. We talked about that in terms of the pyramid, the self-knowledge, and the options knowledge. As you do that, you are either expanding or narrowing the list of options. If you came to your post-bac thinking, this is what I want to do, this is always what I wanted to do, I know this is what I'm going to do, it might be helpful, not that you won't do that, but it may be helpful to expand those things under consideration, to thoroughly clarify for yourself, indeed, that's what I want, and here is why. If you have a huge number of lists of things that are under consideration and you're feeling overwhelmed and you don't know which one to choose, I would work at narrowing those list of options. And the way that you do that is by researching them, either through print, the internet, or actually human resources and talking to people so that you can narrow those lists of things under consideration. You really want to have maybe a number of, say, 3 to 5 solid choices, research those in depth to then come to a place at which you are comfortable making a choice. The choice process here, where you're actually choosing in this guide or this cycle, is where your values, you will be considering your values. What's important to you as an individual? What's the impact of the choice to me as myself, as an individual? What would be the impact of the choice on significant others in my life? And ultimately, what's the impact of this choice on my culture and community at large? Once a choice is made, then you move to taking action. You want to implement that. That could be as simple as, I'm going to apply to graduate school this fall. Or, you know, by the end of the year, whenever the deadlines are, that I want to apply. Or, you know, I've decided this is my program. Or I'm going to explore these 3 opportunities. Anytime you make a choice and you put it into action, it's always a good idea to go back and to reevaluate. What new information do you have about yourself?
And what new information do you have about your options? So, you know, you made a decision to come here to NIH to do some training and to get some experience in research. I don't know. For many of you, that's been a great experience. Then maybe some of you are saying, no, I don't know whether this is really right for me. That doesn't mean that it was not a good choice for you. It means that having come here and engaging in those activities, guess what? You know more about yourself, about what you like, what your strengths and weaknesses are, and you also know more about what it's like to do that sort of work. So it's just a good, it's a good rule of thumb to sort of reevaluate or to come back and reassess. That's a good guide to decision making that you can put into place whenever you're in the process of making a choice. Okay, you've got that blank piece of paper. Take a few minutes to jot down maybe 2 to 3 options that you're considering right now. And what I'd like for you to do is under each of those options, indicate both the pros and the cons for each of those 2 to 3 choices. Okay, so I'll give you a few minutes to jot down some notes for yourself. And then I'm going to have us kind of pair up and share some of that information. So everybody got a couple of options listed? Okay. Go ahead and pair up with someone and share with them sort of what options you're considering right now and what you perceive to be the pros and cons of that. I'm not going to spend a whole lot of time doing that, but just if you would, maybe somebody who you haven't chatted yet with or didn't meet up at the party when we were doing that activity, and just if you would just share a little bit about what you came up with in terms of those choices that you're in the midst of, and what you perceive to be some of the pros and cons of those. Okay? And then we'll finish up with some goal setting.
Thank you.
ahead and finish up. Do I need to give you a 1 minute? Go ahead, 1 minute.
Yeah.
Finish up. I'm sorry. You can have a minute to finish your conversations and say your goodbyes, and then I'll finish up the presentation. Not the best.
Although that's, I mean, Caroline was very good last week. She sent out
a reminder.
I mean, last night I sent out to her because I'm the reminder. Because I cut my philosophy of if I can send something out at night, you can ask what type of question. They show up.
Yeah. Well. Does that happen for other workshops? You get a lot of people sign up and listen and they show. Why would they do that? What do I do? I reserve my spot, but yeah. I don't have to come.
Yeah.
I don't know. What would you think? People when I just don't hear from others, you know, like, I hear what people are doing, the party applications for the kids, a lot of people just don't even RSVP. They don't do anything. How rude. I don't understand that. I know, you could do that fairly quickly. Yeah. Okay. Hopefully your decisions are going to progress just fine and you'll be able to come to closure and make your choice. Sometimes we get kind of stalled or stuck or we're feeling overwhelmed. We're not sure what to do. And there are I just kind of made a slide for some of the potential obstacles to decision making. Sometimes those can be of a more personal nature, and maybe that we're just really tired or we're feeling stressed or overwhelmed or worried about something. We may be sad or just feeling kind of generally down. They could be attitudinal. We might lack the motivation to make the choice. We may fear that we're going to make the wrong choice or fear failure. So those kinds of things can have an impact from an attitudinal standpoint. There are things that may be family related that potentially can get in the way. There may be perceived pressure from others about or expectations about what we might do. There might be some, you know, partner issues, dual career kinds of issues that you need to consider. That balance between work and personal life or work and family is always a delicate one. And those things might make it more difficult to come to a choice. And then societal sorts of things. Those may be historical in nature. They may be economical in nature. Right now is a very difficult economic time. And I know for many people, embarking on a job search, that seems kind of scary. Or thinking about your futures, what does that mean? So those are things that you're needing to work through and kind of think about and plan for. There may be other cultural forces at play that you need to consider in your decision process. We're not going to go over this activity, but I didn't have time to hide these slides. Let me go ahead and tell you about this, and then you can do this on your own because you've got this in your slide notes. This is just a quick activity to look at potential challenges to decision making, and it asks you to list what you believe those barriers or potential obstacles may be, to identify whether they are imposed. You don't have any choice about them. You've got no control. They're imposed upon you, or you do have a choice. Indicate that, and then indicate whether they're short-term, a few days, a few months, a couple of weeks, to longer term, many months, many years. And as you do that, then, consider what you are doing to deal with each barrier, to either remove it, to modify it, or to cope with it better. So that's an activity that you can take with you when you have some free time and do that. Let's turn just a little bit and shift gears just a bit to talk briefly about goal setting. You know, goal setting is a key component to effective planning and preparation.
So we've been talking about the importance of thinking through and planning for career decision-making, engaging in good, effective decision-making, and a part of that is establishing some goals for yourself. Goal setting encourages a proactive approach to your life, not a bad thing, kind of have a sense of what's coming to the future. It helps you to establish your life and your work priorities. When you know what your priorities are, it's easier to set what goals you're going to do. It makes it much easier to determine how you're going to utilize your time. And finally, it assists in creating a plan or a vision for your future. And then having good goals is actually motivating. If you don't set goals for yourself, there can be some problems with lack of motivation to move forward, to take action and to do things. So goals can help to identify your priorities and further enhance your motivation to move forward and take some action. Here's some good goal-setting tips. You want to be sure that when you set goals, they're set as positive statements, things that encourage you rather than, you know, start you thinking critically about yourself. They need to be precise. They help to set priorities. When you write your goals down, you're more likely to achieve them. And I've also heard, although I don't know there's a lot of research to support this, if you tell someone else your goal, again, you're held more accountable, you're more likely to achieve that particular goal. You want to keep your goals small. So if you have a big goal in mind, you want operational goals that lead you there. And this next one, setting performance goals, not outcome goals, is a similar kind of focus. If you say, you know, my goal is to get my PhD, for example, well, that's an important, good, long-range goal, but you don't have a sense of how you're going to get there. So setting those smaller performance goals or operational goals will help to ensure that you have the kind of success and satisfaction in the end that you're looking for. Finally, make sure you're setting realistic goals. Don't ask yourself to do things that are outside of your reach or just don't seem realistic in terms of your lifestyle. Set realistic goals for yourself. Some of you may be familiar with the SMART acronym. This is in a lot of time management and goal setting literature, the SMART acronym. And it's a good it's a good tool to remember when you're setting up some goals for yourself, that they do need to be specific. You need to know what it is that you are trying to achieve. So make them specific. They should be measurable. How will you know when you've achieved it? There needs to be an element of measurement so that you can then say, oh, I've achieved that goal. I got there. They must be realistic, ones that you can achieve. So they need to be attainable, realistic, and achievable for you. Relevant. If they're not consistent with your overall mission and priorities in your life and career and professional life, then you're not likely to achieve them. So make goals relevant. And then finally, make them time-bound. Set up a deadline to accomplish them. Anybody have an idea of a short-term goal or a long-term goal that you've set for yourself? What would be a short-term goal? Anybody interested in sharing? Yes?
Taking the GRE.
Do you have a date set in mind?
March.
Excellent. That's an excellent goal. What about another relatively short-term goal? Yes? Your graduate essay is done. Deadline? The end of the month. Wonderful. How about some short-term goals that you have set for yourselves? Anybody willing to share? Yes? That's a short-term goal. Study tonight. Is that a specific goal? Concept? Well, it is a short-term goal as opposed to a long-term goal, but it's kind of fuzzy and vague. Study tonight. You see what I'm saying? If you want to ensure that you study tonight, you might say study blank, read blank, write blank this evening. Accomplish that. So you're much more specific about what it is that you're trying to accomplish, and there's a time element this evening by 11, you know, whenever. You need sleep, right? So don't stay up all night doing that. Anybody else? A long-term goal? Too scary? You don't want to do it?
To become an MD.
Okay, good goal. But but would you need to set that in operational language? So if that's your overall goal, like that's the top goal, it's putting in some smaller, shorter-term goals to get you there. Have you taken the MCAT? So you're going to study for the MCAT. You want to put some specific goals in place to prepare for retaking the MCAT. Take your MCAT. That would be another goal. And then, you know, applying to medical school. All right. So you can see how that SMART acronym helps us. Okay, here's some tips for taking action. First and foremost, you need to know what you want. If you don't know what you want, like my slide at the very beginning of my presentation, chances are you're not going to get it. So do know what you want and put some steps in place to get there in a reasonable length of time. Set both short-term and long-term goals, and we just kind of illustrated how that's very important. When I started graduate school, during one of the orientations, one of the faculty members shared a cartoon with all of us who were beginning our graduate study, and it was this huge elephant on a giant platter, and this gentleman at the end with a big bib around his neck at this huge, long dining table. And so there's this big platter of this elephant, and he's got a knife and a fork in his hands. And the caption was, "You can eat an elephant if you eat it one bite at a time." And I have thought about that so much in my life, but particularly during my graduate school years. And I just like to use that illustration because it was such a great visual to me about life in general, but certainly about graduate school, that you really have to kind of take it a step at a time. You can't eat the whole elephant. You'll choke, for one, but you're going to be overwhelmed just looking at it. So you really have to think of the goals that you're setting for yourself in smaller, short-term, more realistic steps. And setting those realistic goals, make sure that they're attainable for you. And then consider the possibility of an individual development plan or even a job search plan or a graduate, graduate school plan, because many of you are considering graduate school at this point. Just some final thoughts. Job searching, applying to graduate school, thinking about what you're going to do in your futures is really hard work. And for many, it's like a full-time job. So don't get down on yourself because it's overwhelming and it feels hard. Just make sure that you're building in some rewards for yourself. Take breaks. Recognize your successes and achievements. Maintain that kind of work and personal life balance so that you are still getting good exercise, that you're taking good care of yourself, that you've got some good self-care in mind, that you're continuing to eat. You don't stay up all night studying for the GRE or the MCAT. Make sure that you're taking good care of yourself. Keep a proper perspective. This is not all that your life is about. There are lots of other aspects of you that probably came out in our party game today. So make sure that you are mindful and continue to recognize this is only just one part of you. Avoid unnecessary pressure, both from yourself and potentially from others, and surround yourself with positive people. All too often, we get caught up in the negativity of those around us. And what likely happens is that we are pretty negative and self-critical too. And that's not helpful to us. That's not helpful to us in helping us have greater happiness and satisfaction, success in our lives. And it doesn't make us feel very good about ourselves either. So surround yourself with positive people and ensure, know who your support network is and use them. Use them whenever you possibly can. Thank you very much for your time today. I appreciate everyone's patience with me at the beginning and getting my slides up and going. And good luck to all of you. I'll stick around for a couple minutes if you have any questions or you want to chat with me.